Good evening. Yeah, it's good to be here. I just retired from the university about 5 months ago, and so I've been doing this for really a long time. And you would think that after doing this, you know, 100, 500, 1,000 times, that, you know, it would just be, you know, all zen all the time. But no. I've had one of the really great things about being a college professor is that as long as you're productive, they sort of let you do whatever you want. And so I've had the really, really good fortune of having a career where whatever was most wildly interesting to me, that I could just pursue that. So this is a story about a line that I started following about 10 years ago. So I was doing a workshop on acceptance and commitment therapy in Eugene, Oregon. And that has been kind of one of the main research efforts that I've engaged in my career. And I had the very good fortune to have my first evolutionary biologist at a workshop for acceptance and commitment therapy. And at the time, a friend of mine who does child health, adolescent risk research, Tony Biglin, what Tony was doing is he was conspiring to put David and I, David Sloan Wilson and I, in the same room. And David asked me this question, and the question was, do you think about psychology from the perspective of evolution science? And my first response was a little defensive. I was sort of like, well, of course I do. You know, I'm a science guy, evolution, good. But I knew that I wasn't, that there was something about the question he was asking me that I wasn't answering, you know, that I wasn't responding to. And, you know, I started reading David's books on evolution science and other evolution science books, and I just couldn't quite put it together. Over the last 10 years, I've had the benefit of becoming good friends with David Sloan Wilson, and have also had the chance to be on a panel and present with Eva Jablonka, who is a Polish-born evolutionary biologist who studies epigenetics. And these two have had as large an influence on me as anyone in psychology ever had on my understanding of psychology. So I started reading David and Eva and some other people, and I still couldn't quite put it together. And then I was doing another workshop just maybe 6 months after that in Sweden. And we were on the edge of this beautiful, pristine lake in the Swedish forest. No running water, no electricity, just this perfect sort of stillness at this place. And I was leading, about to lead an exercise. And the therapeutic work that I've done is value-centered work. So it sort of recognizes that doing therapy involves a lot of hard work and people facing into things that are difficult to face into, people moving in their lives in places that make them profoundly uncomfortable, anxious, afraid, and that people shouldn't do things that are painful unless there's a good reason for them to do those things. And so the work is very centered on values. And so whenever I work with a client, I tell them, you know, the next piece of work we're going to do is going to be some of the hardest work that you've ever done in your life. We don't want to do hard work for nothing. And so tell me, what is it that you care most deeply about? And, you know, maybe there's a way that we can dedicate our work to what you care most deeply about. And so I was introducing this values exercise at this workshop of psychotherapists. And I said, you know, you can do this exercise and orient yourself towards any value you want. And I put up this array of values like being in a couple's relationship, friendship, community engagement, all these different things. And one of them was self-care. And I would always tell people this sort of joke, you know, it was my big joke. And I would say, well, you know, when it comes to strong physical exercise, I'm with H.L. Mencken. I lie down until the urge passes. And, you know, the people in the room all laugh like, ha, 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 you know, and I laughed. And so then we go into this values exercise, and I had everybody in the room in the midst of this kind of mindful state. You know, I'm leading this mindfulness exercise, and I ask them, think about somebody in your life who you love like crazy. And whenever I lead these sort of mindfulness exercises, I do them at the same time that I'm leading them. And so I ask them, think about someone who you love like crazy, just in the most complete and unreasonable way. And I thought about the faces of people that I loved. This is a person who I love, that's Aiden. She's one of my graduate students' babies who has spent enough time at my house that she calls my wife Grandma and she calls me Grandpa. So I asked people in this exercise, I asked them to, you know, and I'll ask you, you know, to think about somebody who you love like crazy, you know, and I thought about a face like this. And then I asked them, you know, has that person who you love, have they ever caught you looking at them? You know, so that, you know, they can see in your eyes, you know, how much you love them. You know, and I'm doing the same thing. I'm looking at these faces that I love and catching those moments in time, you know, where that person catches you, you know, looking, beholding them. And I said to them, imagine a harder thing that you were someone who you loved that much, you know, without reservation. What would you offer to yourself? And all of a sudden my joke was like not funny anymore, you know, because, you know, if I said that joke about Aiden and I said, whenever she gets the urge to strong physical exercise, I have her lie down until it passes, it wouldn't be funny at all. And it set me to wondering, you know, when between like this day and this day, it became okay to neglect Kelly. You know, when did it become okay not just to neglect Kelly, but to make jokes about it? You know, so sitting there on the side of that lake, I thought I would not treat someone I love that way. And so when I came home, back to Oxford, Mississippi, it was in the summer, just a little before this time of year, a little before my 55th birthday, in 2009, and I determined that I was gonna take myself to yoga, like that, the years of sedentary behavior, of sitting hunched over a computer, that I would never do that to someone that I loved. And so I determined that to treat myself just like someone who I loved. And so I went, I called a friend of mine in Sweden who had visited me there and told me about this really good yoga studio and this really good yoga teacher at the studio. And I found out when she was on the schedule and I went and I paid for a year of yoga. I asked her, is this class we're gonna have today okay for a beginner? It was an Ashtanga yoga class. Now, if you know anything about yoga, Ashtanga yoga is a particularly vigorous yoga practice that was designed for adolescent boys, and not for 55-year-old men, you know, who are like a little paunchy and extremely sedentary. And she was very sweet, and she said to me, you know, it'll be just fine. And she said, before the class, she said, I just want to show you this one thing. Like, we might be, you know, in a pose, and you might find that the pose is difficult, that your leg starts to shake or something. So I want to show you an adaptation of these poses that you can do at any moment in the class, and it'll be a correct pose for you. And then she showed me how to do child's pose. And she said that that is a correct way to do any pose in yoga. The problem is I couldn't really do that pose because, you know, I had a kind of a obstruction here. And I didn't have enough flexibility in my ankles, you know, and so it was kind of, you know, like child's pose badly, you know. But while I was down like that, and I spent a lot of time in that pose in that class, and when I was down on the floor like that, my teacher would come over and she'd stand over the top of me and watch me breathe, you know. And she'd watch my breath rise, and she would, you know, lay a hand on my hip and on my shoulder, and as I breathed out, she'd sort of lean down into me. And then as my breath rose, she let back. And then she reached for the other shoulder and my other hip and just watched me breathe and then leaned down into me. And I sort of settled. I didn't expect to like it. You know, I mean, I had a story, and my story was, I hate exercise. You know, lie down until the urge passes. And I had decades of evidence that that was a true story, you know. But there was something about being in this place, you know, and about what I was doing there. And it wasn't just about the yoga, you know. It was about treating myself in a different way and what that meant. I was going, I had some kind of secret posts on yoga. I was telling people that I was making a birthday present for myself. And they were trying to guess, you know, what kind of birthday present I was making. And I said, well, you know, and they guessed things like Prada shoes and like that, because I do have a certain affection for expensive shoes. But I told them, no, it's more like the kind of a birthday gift like a child would make, you know, with popsicle sticks and paper and glue and, you know, coloring, you know, like that. And I think I was going about 3 or 4 weeks, and I was laying on the floor at the end of a class in one of these kind of gentle supine twists, you know, with my knees sort of up and off to one direction and turned in the other. And the lights were down low. It was the end of the class. And just all laid out on this hardwood floor. And I looked around myself, and I was surrounded by all these people who had taken time out of the middle of their day to take care of themselves, just like someone they loved. And I was one of them. And then I found out that yoga is yet another thing that I can do while crying, which is good, because I cry doing just about everything. I did not go back to the Ashtanga yoga class for probably another 9 months or a year. I started going to classes that were gentle yoga for special needs. And so, you know, people who were like recovering from surgery and, you know, women in their third trimester of pregnancy. Stevie likes to tell people I went to the prenatal yoga classes, and people are like, oh, she's like, no, really, he's at the prenatal yoga classes. It was good, you know. What David sent me off into was, you know, when I started to take seriously this idea of caring for myself, one of the, you know, pieces of that was, well, you know, if you got like a new pet that is like an animal you don't know about, the first thing that you would do is go find out about that animal. So, you know, if it's a dog, well, what do they need to eat? And what kind of toys do they need? And how much exercise do they need? You find out about them, right? And so I thought, well, if I'm going to take care of Kelly you know, I got to find out like what kind of monkey he is so that I get the right kind of monkey chow. And I sort of became obsessed with finding out like, well, what are the optimal conditions for a human being? You know, what are the things that we need? And inevitably, that ends up being an evolutionary question. You know, like what kind of creature have we become, and what are the optimal conditions for that? Now, this, you know, and I did what an academic does when, you know, confronted with something like this. You know, I read and read and read and read hundreds of articles and books, but not just about, like, about psychology, but first about evolution and about genetics, and then about epigenetics and the way that, you know, that, you know, genes aren't really destiny, that they're malleable. You know, I started reading about nutrition and biomechanics and microbiology and physics. I mean, there's just like no, I'm a kind of a science nerd. And so I like to get a hold of a thread and I just start following it, you know? So you might wonder, like, how do you end up with physics? Well, I'm learning about movement. And if you start to learn about movement and biomechanics, then you might start learning about joints. And if you learn about joints, one of the things you find out is that most of your joints are these synovial joints. And the synovial joints contain something called a non-Newtonian liquid. Do you know what that is? I didn't either, you know? So I had to read some like engineering and physics to find out what is a non-Newtonian liquid. Now this is some genius business about what kind of monkey we are. Synovial fluid is this substance that when it's not under load, mechanical load, it's super slippery like a lubricant. But as soon as you put pressure on it, it becomes firm like a shock absorber. And your knees are filled with this and your hips are filled with this, and you've got 33 or 34 of those joints in each one of your feet. And it means that, you know, every time you lift off your foot, it turns into a lubricant. And then as soon as your foot comes down, it becomes like a shock absorber. How do those tissues stay healthy? Well, by movement. So you see how it is? I start off as a psychologist, and the next thing, I'm reading like engineering and biomechanics and zoo science. I'm reading about animals that are in places that they don't belong and the ways that they get ill when they're in those places. I'm reading about, you know, when we go to study illness in animals, we don't go find the sick ones. We make them sick, right? Now, I don't want to argue that that's a good idea, and very often I think it's done for very bad reasons. But we can learn a lot about what makes us sick by understanding what makes other social mammals sick, for example. My conclusion, I ended up having to take a year off from the university just to read, because I didn't have time to actually do my job and all of this reading at the same time. So I took a year off and I read, and I took a yoga teacher training. That was pretty fun. There's a guy in evolutionary biology named Dobzhansky, and Dobzhansky famously said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution." And what David was saying to me, I think, was that nothing in psychology makes sense except in light of evolution. Like, if you want to understand why people do what they do, feel what they feel, think what they think, you need to understand us in the context of evolution. The conclusion that I had of reading broadly across modern burden of disease was that nothing in the modern burden of a global burden of disease makes sense except understood in light of evolution. Now, if you want to understand why I would say this, you have to start to ask, what kills? You know, what kills human beings? And the answer to that question depends on the time frame that you're asking the question. So what killed human beings for millions of years? And the the many thousands of years preceding the modern era was that the world was really out to get us. You know, it broke our bones. You know, some of its creatures ate us if they had the opportunity. It infected us with, you know, various kinds of microbes. We often didn't have enough calories, many died in childbirth. Many died before their fifth birthday. So if you want to get a sense of the scale of this, this is a graph of child mortality. So this is the percentage of children born alive who survived to their fifth birthday. And it is running back to 1800. So 200 years ago, across the world, we buried approximately half of our children before their fifth birthday. 43% is the best estimate. Right now, the 2015 data, there might be 2017 data on this now, it's 3.9% globally. 3.9 out of 100 instead of 43 out of 100. It's an order of magnitude reduction in infant mortality. Maternal mortality is another good sort of marker of this. And here you can see from 1800 to 1940. And if you look at the first part of the graph, we have some data there for Finland. There are some countries that we have a much longer stretch of data on. Finland's one of them. And that is pretty much the state, if you look at estimates of countries where we have data, is something like 800 to 1,000 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births, right? That orange line there, that's the United Kingdom, and where we start to have data there is right about the time of the Industrial Revolution is starting to take off. And when you get about to the Second Industrial Revolution, so the late 1800s, you start to see all these other countries begin to converge that start to industrialize, and we start seeing rates in this 400 to 500 range. Also note, you can actually tell when there were things like famines and things like that. So if you look there in the 1860s, there was a huge potato famine in the late 1860s, and you can see child mortality spikes up there, maternal mortality spikes up there. If you follow it out just to this side of 1920, you can see the great flu epidemic of the late teens and that spike there, and you'll see that in all kinds of mortality data. Now I want to show you something that is like amazing. Like, to me, it's amazing. So this is 1800 to 1940, and now I want to show you the graph right after the Great War. Look what happens. They just plummet. And all of that up and down, feast and famine, diseases coming through and taking huge numbers of people, it just flattens out. And look, Poland is at the lowest level, is one of the lowest rates of maternal mortality in Europe. The United States is shamefully has almost triple the maternal mortality rate. That's two orders of magnitude of change. See, these things are not killing us anymore. That's not what's killing us in the modern world. Then we died of diseases of poverty, essentially. The lack of calories, lack of food, lack of potable water, lack of sanitation. We don't die of those things anymore, or only rarely. You know, this is what we die of. You know, we die of too much, too many calories, the wrong kind, placed in the wrong place. It's cardiovascular disease, cardiometabolic disease. And one of the things to recognize about these is the incredible ambiguity about the causes of these illnesses. So you see things like type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, and these kinds of things, and they're extremely complexly determined, right? It's not like infectious medicine where you get this microbe and you get this disease. This is what we're dying from. We're dying from stressors that occur in the world that we live in. We stress about our neighbors, we stress about the countries next door, we stress about how much we stress. And the outcomes of that, look like this. 50 years ago, the rate of diabetes in the United States was about 1%. 60 years ago, 1%. 40 years ago, it was 3%. So just in the last 40 years, it has tripled the rates of diabetes in the United States, type 2 diabetes, that is. Obesity rates have likewise tripled in the United States to 35%. You look at other industrialized countries, here's the UK, rates of diabetes similarly about 8%, 29% obesity rate. There's Poland, not quite as high obesity rate, but I guarantee that it has gone up two or threefold in the last maybe three decades. And it's not just physical illness, right? This isn't just a matter of physical illness. You look at things like depression and anxiety. So this is in the European region, World Health Organization data, 44 million depressed, 37 million anxious. According to the Global Burden of Disease collaborator, so there's a number that they use to talk about the societal burden of different diseases, and one of the metrics is what they call years lost to disability. So not necessarily people who have died, but people who have chronic illnesses that are taking away from their ability to function fully in their lives. Mental illness is number two cause of years lost to disability globally. The overwhelming bulk of that is depression. Certainly depression, anxiety is about 90% of it. That's not even including substance dependence. So just that mental health bundle there. Number two, years lost to disability. And that obesity and diabetes epidemic and this current epidemic are not unrelated. So these are National Health Services, UK National Health Services data. If a person is obese, they have a 55% increased risk of becoming depressed. If a person is depressed, they have a 58% increased risk of becoming obese. Like, these are not separate things. Everything interacts. Here's a map that I got, and this is from a drug maker or a drug distributor, so a prescription company in the United States. At the time when these data were collected, this was 2011 data, this company covered 65 million lives in the United States, so a great, huge national prescription provider. And what this map is about is if you're a prescription provider, you want to know different parts of the country use different medications at different rates, and you want to know where you need to stock the shelves for different kinds of medications. Those red states right there, up in that mid-south area, are called the diabetes belt because the rates of diabetes are just astronomical in that location. That same location also has the highest use of psychiatric medications, with 23% of the covered lives taking at least one psychiatric medication. These are not separate things. You know, why? Now, why? Now, one of the things that you see are like all of these genetic studies, and I'm like all for genetic studies, but you just have to know this is not a genetic problem, because something that changes over the course of 30 or 40 years, well, you know, same gene pool, same people, you know, very often over a time frame like that. It can't be genes, except about the context in which genes are finding themselves. I think that the best explanation for the modern burden of disease that we see, and it cuts across cardiovascular disease, metabolic illness, mental health. The other one that, the one that's number one, I said mental illness is number two. Number one is back, is musculoskeletal pain, mostly back, neck, and shoulder pain. That's the number one cause of years lost to disability worldwide. Why? Well, I think that the best argument is for an evolutionary mismatch. Now, what do I mean by that? People have seen the movie Free Willy, right? And the killer whale with, you know, the dorsal fin that sort of flopped over like that. Well, it turns out that that flopped over dorsal fin is almost never seen in wild killer whales. Wild orcas, if you see it, it'll be like as a result of an injury or something, and it usually corrects itself. But it's very rare. In whales that are in captivity, it's an incredibly common feature that they have that floppy dorsal fin syndrome. Now, you could probably go and do a genetic study, and you'd find that some of these whales are more susceptible than other whales to, you know, floppy fin syndrome. Except you could also look at how whales live, right? When you're a whale in the wild, these animals are diving with tremendous speed and in great depth. And that dorsal fin allows them to navigate and move through the water, right? But if you're swimming around in a swimming pool and your dorsal fin is sticking up in the air, it really doesn't matter what shape that dorsal fin is. So the shape of that fin, of course, is genetic. I mean, what isn't? Of course it's genetic, but it's genetic in a particular kind of environment. And in an environment where you're moving at great speed and diving to great depths, then it looks like this. And if you aren't, it tips over. So this is the project. You know, what are the modern diseases of captivity? I started reading the science on zoo-kept animals, and there are a whole host of illnesses that you see in zoo-kept animals that you never see in wild types of the same animals. So for example, gorillas in zoos will often get cardiac disease and die of cardiac disease very young. In the wild, they don't get heart disease. Horses that are persistently kept in a paddock, so they're inside of a stall like this, will sometimes begin doing this behavior where they bite on the wood at the top of the stall, and when they do it, they swallow air down into their stomach, and it can be a serious medical problem for them. And if you get somebody who knows about horses and they come out and look and you say, how do I get them to stop biting on the top of the thing? Here's how to do it. Take them out of the stall, because horses that are pastured don't do that behavior. African gray parrots will pluck all of their own feathers out and denude themselves of feathers. It's a quite common thing in captive African gray parrots. You never see it in the wild ones. These are illnesses that are produced by an animal that evolution developed to live in a particular niche, who now live in a different one. Now, what about human suffering? And I am still a psychologist, and I think we have some incredible wrong and bad ideas about the sources of human suffering, or at least they are so much only a fragment of the story as to be damaging to be told as the whole story. So usually when you talk about mental health problems, people are told a story about some kind of broken brain, some kind of chemical imbalance in their brain, which is probably caused by some kind of broken gene. So some kind of defective gene that leads, you know, to some kind of defective brain process. Now, I want you to know that there is not now, nor has there ever been, any blood test for any major mental disorder. Not one. There's not a brain scan. There's not a blood test. There's not any sensitive and specific biological marker for a single psychiatric disorder that we have. Have you ever noticed when you go to the psychologist, they don't give you a blood test, right? Because there's nothing to detect there. Now, am I saying that brains and genes don't have anything to do with it? Well, of course not. They have lots to do with it, but the idea that the cause of a person's suffering is a broken brain or broken genes probably your mom gave you, right, is false. It's false. You know, what this is a kind of an overextended a medical metaphor. Really, even it's only actually very workable for a small part of medicine, even. In modern lifestyle illnesses, it's a much more complex story. Brains are always brains in context. Genes are genes in context. So Eva Yablanka, a wonderful epigeneticist, tells us in Evolution in Four Dimensions that only 2% of human diseases are what's called monogenic. So monogenic means if you have the gene, then you have the disease. 2%. So that means the other 98% of human diseases are caused by multiple streams of causation, some of which are certainly genetic, but there's no depression gene, there's no anxiety gene, there's no addiction gene. Now, I know a ridiculously large amount about my own genome, so I've had myself genotyped, and not just the 23andMe version, but the, you know, one that tunnels down and finds all those risky gene variants and everything, and it turns out, I got a couple of those. So, you know, the one that used to be called the depression gene, you know, where if you have like a short variant of this depression gene or of this SERT gene, serotonin reuptake gene, that it puts you at greater risk for depression and some other kind of psychological problems, got that one. But is that one a determinant of people becoming depressed? Turns out, no. In fact, a woman named Kaufman did a study of people with this particular genetic variant that I have that looks like it might be a risk factor for depression. She took children that had a kind of double whammy. So they had the risky gene variant, plus they also had a home life that was so disrupted that they had to be permanently removed from their parents' home. So it was violent enough or chaotic enough or impoverished enough in some regard that they had to be permanently removed. So all the kids have these two things in common, which is this risky gene variant and a harsh social environment. So this sounds like a perfect kind of stress diathesis sort of a situation. What she found out, though, was that she asked lots and lots of questions as she followed these kids through their development. And one of the questions she asked was, did the birth parents have any regular contact with the child as they were growing up, even though they didn't have custody? And if the birth parent had regular contact with them, defined in a very meager way, one time per month while they were growing up, if that was true, it erased 80% of the risk conferred by that gene. 80% of the risk. Just by that little bit of social goodness, you know, that day when you're sitting at home wondering why your parents left you, and they come that day, you know, and the next month and the next month after that, just that little bit. Now, some of the science on that CERT gene suggests that what that gene may code for is social sensitivity, and that the people who have these short variants of that social or of that CERT gene seem to be a little more sensitive to social contingencies. And what it means is they're easier to hurt, but they're also easier to help through social goodness. There's lots of examples that are just like this. The FTO gene is a gene that predicts obesity in the Framingham Heart Study. So it was a big heart study, took place over the course of 40 years. And what they found was that the FTO, this particular variant of the FTO gene, predicted obesity, but only in people born after World War II. For the people who were born prior to World War II in the data set, it wasn't predictive of obesity at all. So wait a minute, is it a risk gene? Is it a risk factor? If it's 1930, no. You know, if it's 1960, yes. I mean, the gene didn't change. It's the same gene, right? But something changed, right? The world changed. The whole world changed. Let me give you one more example of the malleability of genes to give you the sense that genes are genes in context. I actually was profoundly uninterested in genes before I got connected up with David and Eva. And the reason, when I wrote my sabbatical plan, I wrote this crazy, 20-page single-space sabbatical plan to my chair, telling him all this stuff I wanted to read and writing about epigenetics and all this kind of thing. And I got home, none of it was about psychology. I got home and he said, I had no idea you knew that much about genetics. And I said, well, I didn't think there was anything I could do about it. okay, you got bad genes, now what? But it turns out there's something you could do about it. So here's a guy, Stephen Cole. He studies what's called social genomics. Right? So social genomics is this idea that how your genes code depends on social context. So a rat is a deeply, deeply social mammal. They say a rat is most at home in a pile of other rats. And in fact, you can model depression and anxiety by isolating rats or exposing them to social hostility. So if you isolate these animals where they can't see or hear or interact with other rats, you can then go in and plot their genes. And what you're seeing are heat plots of their genes there. So the top ones are the isolated rats, and the bottom one is a heat plot of the control rats that are living in a colony and hanging out with other rats and doing, what rats do. And what you see there is the red ones are genes that are coding really hot, producing lots and lots of protein, and the green ones are downregulated. So these genes are suppressed, maybe entirely silent, coding for way fewer proteins. And what you see is almost a perfect sort of mirror image in these two. Which genes are there? Coding for lots. These are pro-inflammatory processes, things that have to do with glucose regulation, things that have to do with coding for stress hormones. So how much stress hormone do you produce? And then when the stressor is chronic, like people produce cortisol, right? It's one of the stress hormones. You have a gene called the GR gene that codes for proteins that take cortisol out of the system. So it's kind of like your body is in a stressful situation, it spills out all this cortisol, the GR gene codes for proteins that clean up that cortisol that is systemic under stress. Now, if you get stressed for a long time, the GR genes will look like those green ones down at the end, is it'll start to down-regulate them. Because if you're in a dangerous or threatening environment, you don't want quick cleanup. You know, when you want your babies born with a head on a swivel, and you want to stay, you know, tuned up all the time, you know, ready to fight off an enemy or run from a predator, right? And so what you have on the top here is an animal under this chronic stress whose very genome, which parts are coding and which parts are silenced, is being controlled by social interaction. Here's another example, one last example. This is a study of individuals with mindfulness practices. So broadly understood, two different studies. They looked at three groups. One group is a group that has had a regular mindfulness practice for a long-term period. So people with 5, 10, 20-year long mindfulness practice. Another group is a group with no mindfulness practice at all. And then one that I think is particularly interesting, I think for us in healthcare, is this group, this other third group, which is a group that's had a short exposure to some kind of mindfulness based treatment. So mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. They've taken up yoga or Tai Chi or something like that. What you see when you look at the long-term practitioners versus the non-practitioners is differences in the coding of 2,200 genes. Now that's about 10% of the human genome that is different between the regular meditators and the non-meditators. That more interesting group, you see more than 400 genes that are coding differently, even with this very small exposure, you know, maybe 10 or 12 weeks exposure to a mindfulness practice. Which genes are being altered? Those same genes that are being altered when we see those rats under isolation, except in a reverse fashion. So you're seeing improvements in glucose regulation, improvements in these inflammatory, pro-inflammatory processes. Now, if you think about the modern burden of disease, where do you see these in kind of chronic inflammatory processes? And the answer is everywhere. Every mental health condition you can think of, you'll see these kind of heightened pro-inflammatory processes, interference in immune function. So it upregulates innate immune function, and it actually downregulates adaptive immune function. So innate immune function is kind of a blunt instrument immunity. You know, it's like if you get injured, then you get anticoagulant, you get extra blood flowing to the injury, certain hormones are produced that help you survive that. Adaptive immunity is your body learning to fight different kinds of pathogens. So you get some kind of illness, the measles or something like that, your body learns to build antibodies to correct that. When you're under stress, this one goes up and this one goes down. And when you isolate these rats, you get the sort of illness-producing version of that. When you get people to sit for a mindfulness practice, you get the reversal of those things. Now, if you think about these things from an evolutionary perspective, it makes perfect sense. If you're under threat and your body has tons of glucose slopping around in it, this is a wonderful thing because every cell in your body knows how to use glucose to produce energy. You know, no processing required. It is ready to go to work. So having lots and lots of glucose slopping around in your body is great if you're going to have to run, fight, or hide. But if you don't have to run, fight, or hide, it's incredibly toxic and corrosive. Now, there's another piece of context out there that we are suffering under in the modern world that is this idea that suffering is itself a disease. And that if you are suffering in any way, pain, mental, physical, or otherwise, that is a sign of illness and needs to be corrected. The great spiritual traditions all know better. They all know better that suffering is part of living. Now, the other piece of the kind of modern mantra, and we've taught people to do this, baby's got a fever, Tylenol. You got a headache, go to the medicine cabinet. Now, this is even in the face of the fact that, for example, antipyretic drugs, most fevers are benign, right? If it's high, then it needs to be managed and lowered. But fevers that are fairly low grade are just not dangerous. In fact, if you give people medication to lower their fever, this low-grade kind of fever, it actually prolongs the illness. So it produces immediate comfort, but long-term illness. Same thing in chronic pain, like we're seeing an epidemic of opioid use all over the planet. It produces short-term benefits, but in the long term, it produces long-term increases in pain and disability. Suffering is not a disease. And this other piece that we see in the modern world is this incredible demand for uniformity. You know, that people feel like other people and think like other people. This is a picture of me in the first grade, and that's my grade report from the first grade. And if you could open it up and look inside, what you'd find, it would say, Kelly doesn't stay in his seat. Kelly talks during class. Kelly, goes around and bothers other students when they're trying to do their work. Kelly's running all over the place. Now, what do you suppose would happen if I was in school right now? Can you see the diagnosis? I'd be lining up with the other kids in the hall to get my ADHD medicine. Now, fortunately, this was like 1960. So, there was nobody taking ADHD medication. They just thought I was bad, and they called my mother and they said, Mrs. Blinko, Kelly is being bad, Come on. See, they thought I wasn't paying attention. I was paying attention. I just wasn't paying attention to what they said I should pay attention to, And guess what? We're not all the same in terms of attentional processes. It's true. I'm sort of, like this. And you know some people that are like that and some people that are like this, right? Do you maybe know people like that? Well, here's the thing. Some people who are really, really like this can do things that people like me can't do. Like, don't hire me as your accountant. I don't do rows and columns, But people like me can do things that the accountant can't do. Like sometimes, because we're looking here and here, sometimes we see things that go together that other people don't see, And if you look around you, even in this room, and look at the shapes of people's, ears and noses and the color of their hair and the texture of their skin, there's just nothing but this extraordinary palette of variability. And why would we expect the inside to be any different than that? Do some of us, are some of us more vulnerable than others? Do some of us hurt more easily? Yes. I tell my clients, I say, some of us are like special needs, like me. I need extra care. Now there is this like big lie. And the big lie is that suffering is a disease and that genes are destiny and brains are destiny. The difference is a disease, and they point to me and they say, well, Wilson, he's an academic, and what does he know about real suffering, about real disability? And I have to say to them, fuck you. Because I know about being that guy because I am that guy. So that's me in 1979, my wife Diana took that picture in 1979. And if you look in that guy's eyes, you can maybe like see somebody who, like the old rock and roll song used to say, it takes a whole lot of medicine to make me feel like I'm somebody else. And that is this guy. If I could just get the right mix, You know, I could stand to stay inside of my own skin. In 1985, I spent a month in a locked psychiatric hospital, and then I checked out of the locked psychiatric hospital and spent a month in a drug and alcohol rehab unit. So if people don't think I know up close and personal about suffering, they don't know me. Now, sometimes people think I'm like some kind of a genetic denier or something like that, like I don't believe in genetic risk, and so like let me just lay that to one side. So in my family, I buried my brother Randy in 1987 at the age of 36 by suicide. In 2011, I buried my brother David at age 53 from a massive cerebral hemorrhage. And in 2013, I buried my baby brother Michael at the age of 47 from a heart attack. Do you see this epidemic I was talking about here? You know, that has happened over the last 50 years as we've conquered these old killers. These new ones have risen up and it is home in my family. So do you think I believe in family-wise risk? Yes. But I'm at risk for something else also. So this is my mom's generation. This is my mom's generation. That's my mom in the middle there. We lost her a couple of years ago. This was taken in 2013. And these are all of her siblings, six of them, all surviving siblings. My mom's wearing her Curves t-shirt there. I don't think she actually did any exercise at Curves, but she, you know, liked to talk to people and that. The guy over on the right here, that's my Uncle Jerry. And back in the 1950s, my Uncle Jerry worked for the telephone company and they had to climb up those telephone poles, you know? And back in those days, they didn't use like a machine to lift you up there. You had this kind of a big leather belt that you would wear and a spur in each one of your shoes and you'd just climb up there. And so my Uncle Jerry, on his 80th birthday, he still has those. And he decided to climb the telephone pole out in front of the house. I don't think my Aunt Edie was very happy about this. See, I'm at risk for this also. Right? In a single generation. Same genes. It's a lie. Suffering is not a disease. Difference is not a disease. And you are not broken. As Eva tells us, genes are not destiny. Now the question is, where's the on-off switch? Like, where's the thing that buffers that risk? And here's what Stephen Coles has to say about it. He says, this is what a cell is about. A cell is a machine for turning experience into biology. Every day as our cells die off, we're having to replace 1 or 2% of our molecular being. We're constantly building and re-engineering new cells. Your experiences today will influence the molecular composition of your body for the next 2 to 3 months, or perhaps the rest of your life. Plan accordingly. See, what they're talking about is the average half-life of protein. Most genes code for protein, or a lot of genes code for proteins. Gene codes for protein. Protein lives for about 2 to 3 months before it's broken down and you're building new ones. So whatever it is that you did today, or whatever it is that you do tomorrow, determines, you know, what that crop is going to look like, the pattern of activity. So I'm going to offer to you in the next 30 minutes my prescription for myself. You know, like reading all the science, how to take care of Kelly, and I offer it to you to do with as you will. It involves eight practices. For a guy like me who has clear vulnerabilities, clear risk factors, and maybe you're like me. Maybe you walk around and you look pretty good, like you got it all together, but maybe on the inside, you know what I'm talking about. First one is that we want to reduce exposure to toxins. Now, if I said, if we've become ill very recently, the changes have to be recent. So what has changed? Well, in the last 50 or 60 years, thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of new molecules have been produced. Some of them help us beat all of those kind of various pests and bugs and things like that, but some of them helped us beat those various pests and bugs at a tremendous cost, right? We almost lost whole species of birds because DDT worked so well, right? And it turns out there are other ways to do that. And we have had things inside of plastics, endocrine system disruptors, molecules inside different kinds of medications. And we have really very little not long-term knowledge of what the collective burden of that toxic exposure is. One of the things we do know is that you can model many illnesses in animals by exposing them, like for example, to BPAs in plastic. If you expose rats to BPAs in plastic during gestation or lactation, you produce these kind of anxious, depressed, prone rats. Just so you can use many of these molecules to model illness in laboratory animals. Now, a lot of these things produce illness, and we know about them in humans at certain levels. But you know, the good news is we have a pill for that. Except, of course, many of the pills produce side effects. But you know, we have a pill for that also, and then a pill for the side effects of that other thing. In the United States right now, 15% of U.S. adults are taking five or more medications for chronic illness. In people my age, 65 and over, 40% are taking five or more medications. Let me promise, there has never, ever, ever been a single clinical trial where they examined this collective side effects of any group of medications that large. I mean, imagine writing the ethics protocol to do the research study. We want to take these physically vulnerable, ill, older, chronically ill older adults, and we want to give them this big cocktail of medication, and the other half will give a placebo. I mean, they would turn you down in a second. So the doctor can give you those, but there's never been a clinical trial, and there never will be a clinical trial on these crazy drug cocktails. So some of the really clear kind of practices in this is to begin to look for patterns in your own life of toxic exposures that you're taking that you can lessen. So, I, you know, like for years, for example, I used to take a couple of like a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory at night before I go to bed because I had this idea that I slept better with it. But then, I started developing, I ended up with GI problems, and then I took medication for that. And then I found out that if you take this medication for that, that, you know, that can cause these other problems. And by the way, if you try to stop taking them, like, you know, those medicines that do such a great job of stopping stomach acid in your body, you can give those to people with no stomach problems. So healthy control subjects for 8 weeks, withdraw them from the medication, you can produce gastrointestinal symptoms. 8 weeks in healthy subjects. Now, I'm not saying that we should never take these medicines, but to be thoughtful about them and to take the smallest dose possible, you know, over the shortest time frame possible, which is nothing. You know, I had my life saved by, you know, different kinds of medicine. So this isn't an anti-medicine thing. Lowering the burden of alcohol, various kinds of drugs, and I would say in the modern era, unnecessary medication. I mean, we're awash in it. If you go back just a generation, two generations, like my grandfather, you could not get that guy to take a pill. I mean, you couldn't get him to go to the doctor unless he had a broken bone and it was sticking out of the skin, you know? He didn't trust doctors, you know? And he did, you know, he would take an aspirin maybe or something, but, you know, he was reticent about those kinds of things. And we could use a little bit of that reticence. And the marketers of these products, you know, they want us on everything all the time. Move your body. Now, here's an area that has changed dramatically and insanely in the modern era. If you look at primitive humanity for millions of years and the thousands preceding the modern era, you spent your day hunting and gathering, and it was hard physical labor all day, every day. And if you didn't, then you were in calorie debt. And even if you did, you might be in calorie debt or just on the edge of calorie debt every single day. If you look at the Hadza in Tanzania, the average Hadza spends about 135 minutes a day in moderate to vigorous physical activity. 135 minutes a day. Now, that's not all of them, because you know they kitted out the whole tribe with you know, measurement devices. Some of the women are like in their like 60s and 70s that are doing 200 minutes a day of moderate to vigorous physical activity. I mean, they're moving. They're moving all the time. Now, we moved and moved and moved. And if you go back to those plots that I showed you 200 years ago, 75% of the population of Poland and the United States and places like it worked in agriculture. It wasn't like driving a tractor. You know, they're like, you know, swinging a scythe, digging, carrying, pulling, you know, behind a plow. So again, hard physical labor. Now, those jobs, 75% of the workforce was in agriculture 200 years ago. Now in the United States, and I think it's similar in all of the industrialized countries, about 1.5%. Those jobs aren't coming back either, by the way. Now those guys, though, left the farms and they went into the factories where, again, it was hard labor. You know, they're working all day. You do see the rise of the new kinds of illness during this period, and it's repetitive motion kinds of illness start to show up as people do these repeated tasks in factories. But they're up moving, right? What is happening with manufacturing labor is it is plummeting. The Chinese are not taking our jobs. The robots are taking our jobs. The U.S. has the highest industrial output as it's ever had in its history, and industrial labor is plummeting, dropping every day. If you look at something like sedentary behavior, never in human history have so many people earned a living sitting. Like never in human, like, and here's the thing is, we get really, really good at it. Like your body can get really, really good at sitting. And if it isn't good at it, then you can design and buy a chair that makes it even more comfortable to sit, right? I mean, we have chairs that are designed to make it so that you can sit for like 8 hours a day, except here's the problem, is that all your muscles and bones and tendons and innervation and vascularization depend on movement. So just because you can sit all day does not mean it's good, right? I have some friends who have, you know, taken me at my word on this, and they've started doing things like they see clients in therapy, and they see clients sitting on the floor. And Bartosz was at dinner last night, and he asked me, well, what difference does it make if they're sitting on the floor? And I said, you ever notice what happens when you sit on the floor? It's not exactly comfortable. So pretty soon, you know, you kind of like that a little bit. And, you know, you're moving, you know, guess what's happening here? You know, you're moving, you know, you're loading different parts of your body, different bones, joints, moving things around, and you're aiding vascularization, innervation, and all of these kind of metabolic processes. She went home and sawed the legs off of her dinner table. I don't know what her family thought about that. They now see, eat dinner sitting on the ground. When her clients come, she gives them the opportunity to have their session walking. Now, the good thing is that there's just like some kind of movement that basically anyone can do. You can find this old lady up here. She teaches yoga. She's in her 90s. She lives like in New York. Yeah, baby. I want to be her. I might even buy myself a polyester jumpsuit like that. Small things matter, right? Just a little bit, you know, gentle yoga for special needs. The data, the evidence on persistent patterns of movement is spectacular. Like if there's a fountain of youth, this is it. If you look at something like, for example, the data on running, leisure time running. You routinely, in huge data sets, 50, 60,000 people over 15 or 20 years, what you'll see is 45% reductions in cardiac mortality, 30% reductions in all-cause mortality. And here's the beauty of it. It doesn't matter if you run very far, it doesn't matter if you run very often, and it doesn't matter if you run very fast. If you look at like the people who run really, really fast to the ones who run really, really slow to the ones who don't run at all, and you watch the risk reduction, as soon as you get off the couch, it just drops. You get almost 80% of the benefit, even if you only run once a week, really slow and not very far, right? Isn't that great? Now, sometimes when people, you talk about these data, people say, well, yeah, but these people who are running, they're doing all these other kind of healthy activities and everything. But in these big data sets, you can actually ask the data questions about that. And it turns out that if you go in and look just at the smokers, just at the heavy drinkers, just at the people with diabetes, they get even bigger risk reductions. The risk reductions are actually larger for the unhealthy subsets in this population. Now, it doesn't mean that it takes you down to the risk of a non-smoker, but it takes you down in risk more than 30%, more than 45%. Now, when I say run, I want you to understand that my own running practice doesn't exactly look like running. It looks like grinning like an idiot. It looks like, you know, when you see a tree down, you know. Like my model for my movement practice is an 8-year-old boy, you know. And so, like, did anybody here grow up in the countryside? Did you grow up in the country, you know, where there were woods? If you walked and you saw a tree down like that, would you just walk by it? No, you would have to see if you could walk out on that tree, especially if there's a possibility of falling in the water. And maybe you'd like take a friend with you. That's my daughter, Emma. And maybe you'd try to catch tiny loads. So this is what I mean by running. And maybe you'd stop and hang from tree branches. And this crazy old man has taken up over the last almost 5 years barefoot running. So I run outside barefoot now in the Sonoran desert. How about this one? Eat real food. I'm ramping up here. What has changed in that world? Two things I would point to. One is ultra-processed food. Basically, anything that you go to the grocery store and comes in a box or a bag, and you turn it over and you look at the ingredient label, and I guarantee you that there are like 20 or 30 ingredients, and you only know what maybe 4 or 5 of them are. And the other ones are like long chemical names. You have no idea what they are, right? That plus this other thing, which is called the bliss point. So modern ultra-processed food is engineered for overconsumption. It is literally designed. There was a guy who discovered what he called the bliss point. So they wanted to know how much sugar to put in soda pop, in a soda beverage. And so they put the beverage in front of the person with a certain amount of soda in it, and they taste it, good. They put a little bit more in, good. A little bit more in, good. They keep saying good, and then eventually they're like, oh, that's too sweet. And then they back off, and then that's what they, that point there, that bliss point. And they have done that with fats, with sugars, with all manner of food additives designed to cause you to eat more than you plan to eat. Like, this isn't because you're like lazy or stupid or anything like that. It's because it was engineered for that. They even advertise it sometimes. What do they say about Lay's potato chips? I'll bet you can't eat just one, right? See, they know this. And not only do they know they're designing foods for overconsumption, they are designing foods to get your children to overconsume. They are trying to convince your children to overconsume. The diet literature is a hot mess. Good luck figuring it out. But I think there are some really basic things that are really, really clear, and that is a diet that has lots and lots of fast food or lots and lots of other highly processed food is murderous. And if you change to any other kind of diet, vegan, vegetarian, keto, paleo, it doesn't matter. As soon as you stop piling these processed foods into your body, you start to see health change. And it's why it's very hard to show a winner in any of these diets, because all of the ones that they pit against one another have no none of these highly processed foods. I think Michael Pollan is right. Eat real food, not too much, mostly fruits and vegetables. You know, this is the plate of food that your great-grandfather ate on a good day. Real sleep opportunity. So I'm one of these guys, you know how you know people who live on only like 3 or 4 or 5 hours of sleep? Well, I was one of those guys. And so for like decades, I got about 4 hours of sleep a night. I would wake up at about 3 in the morning, and I had this story like I'll never go back to sleep. So I'd just get up, make a pot of coffee, and almost everything I've ever written was written between 3 o'clock in the morning and about 7 o'clock in the morning when everybody started getting up at the house. Now, what I found out is that we know now something about what happens to people's brains when they sleep. And you can actually do live brain scans that can show you that when you sleep, your neurons in your brain get very, very small, and the spaces between them get very, very large. And the flow of cerebrospinal fluid goes way up and flushes these various kinds of toxins that aggregate during your, you know, day of hard thinking. So if you miss sleep, what it means is that you carry a toxic debt into the next day. Now, you think about like the developmental implications of carrying that kind of toxic load day by day, and look at how wide spread it is. In 1960, only 2% of the U.S. population got fewer than 7 hours of sleep a night. 2011, 35%. You know, what changed? Well, everything that regulates sleep has changed, and really, really recently. You know, like when I was growing up, I'll bet you the little house that my two brothers and my mom and I lived in probably had 5 light bulbs in the entire house, you know. Could you stay up and watch TV all night? No, because at about midnight, you know, they'd play the national anthem and then it would go, you know, and it'd be the test screen until the farm news, you know, in the morning, right? Now, I'll bet you every person in this room has a screen in their pocket where they could watch, you know, TV or news or something like that, you know, forever, right? Everyone, right? One of the things that regulates sleep is light, and we live in a world where we can have light anytime we want it. One of the things that regulates sleep is temperature. So millions of years we're out of, you know, out on living outdoors, and at night it gets cool. And when it gets cool, well, then you want to get in close to your buddies and, you know, get a little close and a little sleep and stay warm. And when do you get up? You know, not when the alarm clock goes off. You get up, you know, when it starts to warm up and, you know, it gets light. Like the world regulated our sleep, but now we regulate all those things that regulated our sleep. Now, the good thing about these is that we can actually do something about these. We engineered these as solutions to problems that we had, and we can engineer our way out of them. Now, let me crank, by the way, my bedtime. I've got sleep data for 10 years on myself, actually. This is just like 5 years, and you can see that I'm in bed 8 to 9 hours a day so that I can get 7.5 to 8.5 hours of sleep a night. And I am terrible about policing my sleep. Like, if you're at my house and it's like bedtime, then you're quiet or you're going to get a hotel somewhere. I'll be fast here. Mindfulness practice is a kind of a funny one when you're talking about evolution, but the issue is that, you know, like there's a wonderful book by a guy named Sapolsky called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And the reason zebras don't get ulcers is because, you know, if a lion's chasing over here and then they, you know, they crap themselves, the stress hormones pouring out, glucose pouring out, and then they run, and then they get away from the lion, and it's sort of like, dude, a world without lions, this is so awesome, you know? And all of those processes turn over. But a human being, right, like me, like I'm laying in bed last night, you know, I'm in a hotel, you know, I've got enough food to eat, I've got money in the bank, I've got a retirement account, I got a wife of 40 years, I got a house, you know, my children have, you know, gone to college, you know, and I'm like laying in bed like, oh, what if they don't like me, what if I blow it, you know, what if, you know, what if, you know, I'm confusing, 100 people are going to be there, I might as well be in bed with a lion. I mean, only a human being could have every possible need met, you know, and you're like losing sleep, like, oh, you know, we need practices that are intentional, that give us that pause, you know, that moment where we aren't running, fighting, and hiding. What kind of mindfulness practice? I doubt that it matters. I really doubt that it matters. This is my favorite yoga practice, and I've progressed a little bit from child's pose done badly. I realize I've only got just a couple of minutes here, but I promise you it'll be worth it. We're getting to the best of it. Cultivate your social network. We are social mammals, just like other social mammals. Harry Harlow said it. He's the guy who studied, you know, separating infant monkeys from their moms, and it produces neurotic monkeys. I mean, really, really, really sick monkeys. It's very hard to get them to recover. If you put them in a group, the others in the group will attack them. They'll see them and the damage that they've taken, and they'll kill them. But if you put a baby monkey in with them, the baby monkey will go by this, you know, this really neurotic monkey. The baby monkey will go over to it because it doesn't, you know, it's not socialized, and it is a social mammal, and it wants to be by the other one. And so you can see the photographs. He'll be over by this really neurotic monkey's over in the corner like, and these baby monkey will be over there and putting his hand on there like this. And the other monkey, he's not socialized, so he won't interact with him. But that baby, he'll just keep being over there and putting his hand on him and touching him, trying to hug on him like that, and eventually that monkey will like turn around and start to move and interact with that. And so you can use these baby monkeys to rehabilitate them, right? Did they have a bad gene? No, they had a bad social world. Is it permanent? Maybe not. You know, maybe we can arrange conditions to help people who have been hurt that way. One thing is for sure, social connection is like food and water for a human being. Now we, you know, what has changed? Never in human history have so many people lived alone. Never. I mean, my brother David, who I buried in 2011, until I was 12 years old, we slept in a little bed about this wide. And it was one of those old mattresses that had, you know, hills and valleys, you know, because it was somebody else's mattress before it was our mattress, you know, and it had springs that poked up out of it, and you had to find just the right spot to lay. And my brother David and I would get in that bed, and I would start to scratch in his back, you know, at the top, and I'd scratch my way down his back, and sometimes he'd say a little more there, you know, and I'd get all the way down to the bottom, and then I would turn over. And David would work down my back, and we'd pull in the covers real tight to prevent the monsters from coming out from under the bed or in the closet, especially if the door's partly open. Yeah, or maybe pull it down where you just have a breathing hole. You see what's happening there? Like that's what we're made for. We're made to be together. You know, we're made to be together. We've created a world where it's possible to live alone. But just because something's possible doesn't make it healthy, doesn't make it good. Now, I'm not talking about solitude. I'm talking about isolation. They're different. You know, one is chosen. You know, what's changed is our exposure to social hostility has gone off the charts. When I was little, when you were little, even if everyone in the world hated us, we got an 8-hour break because we all slept at the same time, right? But now you can get exposure. You can get in a fight with somebody 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's never been possible in human history. Let me show you just this one little bit. This is a friend of mine, Jim Cohn, who does these studies. And if you take subjects and you put them in front of a hill like this, and you give them a plate, and they can elevate the plate like this, and estimate how steep the hill is. And if you have them stand there by themselves and estimate it, versus if they stand there with a friend standing beside them, they'll estimate the hill to be less steep and easier to climb if they have a friend next to them. If you play the sound of a baby crying, they'll find the sound more distressing if they're alone than if they're holding the hand of a friend. Right? This is the kind we are. We're the kind that's made to be together. And it turns out that each thing you do propagates through the social network that is around you. So like, have you ever seen the great herd animals, and one of them starts running, and you can see that kind of ripple of movement through them? And how fast do you run? Well, however fast the ones around you are running, that's how fast you run. When do you slow down? Well, when the ones around you start to slow down, then you slow down. See, we're that kind too. There's a epidemiology that shows that if I know you, and you know her, and she knows him, and he knows him, and we know his smoking status, you can predict my smoking status. Even if I don't know any of these people, only this one. It turns out that you can predict what books people read, what music they listen to, things like their smoking status, the kinds of food they eat, by knowing about social network and social connectedness. Each thing you do spreads through the network. I like to ask these two questions every day. You know, what have I done to preserve the social network that I inhabit, and what have I put into that social network? So one is kind of mending, that persistent mending of the social network that we live in. And then the other is, what do we put into that social network? What do we add to it? Well, one of the things I've added to it is movement. And, you know, it's spread out to my daughters and to my graduate students and to their children and to people in Italy. Next to last one. I'm really sorry for holding you up, but I'm telling you, I'm close. Next to last one, practice a meaningful act every day. And this is the land where small things matter. Yesterday I went and spent half a day out at Auschwitz and Birkenau. And it seemed important to go there because I've never spoken about these matters where I didn't also speak of Viktor Frankl. And Frankl has meant a lot to me for a long time. I showed you that picture when I was in rehab and, you know, all like this. And I used to carry a copy of his book around like a compass, you know, because I thought, you know, if Viktor Frankl could find liberation in a death camp, maybe, just maybe, Kelly could find liberation in Spokane, Washington. It's the only picture I took out there yesterday. What has changed, and I think it's an important piece that has changed in the meaningfulness of our lives, is that a tremendous amount of the meaningfulness of our lives is embedded in our social connection. Just think in your own life about the most meaningful aspects of your own life and see how many of those things have to do with social connection. To the extent that connection in our communities are disrupted, this kind of meaning is disrupted. This is truly the land where small things matter. Let me ask you this. And then I'm on my eighth practice, I promise. So let me ask you this. Have you ever thought, or can you think of somebody in your life when you were small who loved. Remember I asked you at the beginning if there was somebody in the world who you loved like crazy. So can you think of somebody who, when you were small, loved you like crazy? Or maybe somebody right now who loves you like crazy, like just in the most unreasonable way. Can you think of somebody like that who loved you like crazy? And see if you can think for a moment about some moment in your life, something you were doing or a place where you were, when you knew that that person loved you. You know, like where were you? What were you doing? See if you can see it. And maybe you can remember the look in their eyes when they looked at you and you could see it there. And I just want to collect. Could you think of someone like that? Could you? Could you think of someone who loved you like crazy? Who is it?
Mom.
Your mom? And what was the moment you thought of?
Well, when I asked her to prepare some stuff and she was tired, but she did it. And like maybe it's a small thing, but there are many things like that.
Yeah. I've asked people this question like in 32 countries over decades, and what people tell you is they tell you about in the kitchen with their grandmother cooking, you know, riding on the tractor with their grandfather, holding their dad's hand. It's tiny, tiny little things. Here's one. I've been traveling and on the road for many years for long periods of time, and when my children were small, they used to dig in my suitcases when I came home, you know, for like airport swag, t-shirts and things like that from other countries. When they got older, they started writing these messages, and they'd put them in like my pockets and my shirt and things like that, so I would be out on the road, and I would, you know, put on a pair of pants or something, and these little messages would fall out. Literally tiny little things. You want to see like one right now? Is the person that you thought of when I asked you if there's somebody in the world, you know, who loved you like crazy, is that person still alive? Anybody? Is that person still alive? And if they are, imagine you were to reach out to him tonight and tell them this crazy college professor from the U.S. asked us if we could think of somebody who loved us like crazy, and I thought of you, and I thought of when we used to, and you said that. How would that be? Small things matter. And this last one, practice self-compassion. You know, what has changed is that in this modern world, we have taught people to make an enemy of their suffering. We've taught people to make an enemy of their differences and an enemy of their complexity. And if you have learned to do that, I would invite you to take a moment and think about some small person in your own world who you love like crazy and see if you can see their face. And imagine if they told you, I don't deserve it. And is there anything that they could say that would change your mind? And if you can see their face and those eyes, I want you to imagine one more thing. I want you to imagine that you were someone who you loved that much and what you might offer yourself. See, that's the face of somebody who knows that they're loved. And this question for all of us, when did it become okay for you to neglect you? Notice how easy it is to take care of others. And one last slide, and this is a medical breakthrough that I want to offer you. Transmitting kindness to someone you love. Ask your doctor, transmitting kindness might be right for you. Does have some side effects in small print, of course. Kindness may be contagious, habit-forming, mood-improving, life-altering, will to live may increase in some patients. These are my practices and I offer them to you. Thank you so much for your patience.